made the following observation and have announced it to the world. The evolution of culture is synonymous with the removal of ornament from objects of daily use. I had thought to introduce a new joy into the world, but it has not thanked me for it. Instead, the idea was greeted with sadness and despondency. What cast the gloom was the thought that ornament could no longer be produced. Weep not, behold, what makes our period so important is that it is incapable of producing new ornament. We have outgrown ornament. We have struggled through to a state without ornament. Behold, the time is at hand. Fulfillment awaits us. Soon the streets of cities will glow like white walls, like Zion, the holy city, the capital of heaven. It is then that fulfillment will have come.
That was a reading from Ornament and Crime by Adolf Loos, and you're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Kinchell.
And we should say, just as we're beginning, that it's an essay replete with picturesque early 20th century racism of the sort which habitually conflates economic, cultural and moral development and peoples of the non-Western world with children, delinquents, and
cannibals. Well, it doesn't equate them with cannibals. It says they are essentially cannibals.
So if you don't really feel like that today, then maybe come back another time.
Also, he's a massive pervert. So there's a bit of that going on.
So there's a lot of problematic content to deal with, but it's all the more... I was going to say enjoyable. I mean, yeah.
There's lots of funny stuff, but it sometimes goes through into the deeply icky.
This is a fun little break from
Corbu. Slightly cracking under pressure with Corbu.
It's also, in case you haven't come across it before, one of the sort of central essays in the canon of early 20th century architectural theory, isn't it?
Well, we were all told about it, but I certainly wasn't expected to actually read it, were you? I think people are a little sheepish about putting it on the reading list, because it's very short. If anyone fancies a interesting architectural theory read on the tube to work or whatever...
Maybe don't let anyone look over your shoulder.
Oh, do. They'd be so excited.
I'm going to think carefully about which bits of it to reproduce on the Instagram.
This one's unillustrated. There were ones with illustrations of exactly what the cannibals were like. We should probably say who Loos was.
First of all, let's just boil down what the essay is about. Ornament and Crime is about essentially saying that progress leads to the eradication of ornament from everyday objects, but also actually from architecture as well.
That's a bit of a... Because actually he doesn't. He says you can have ornament.
Well, in quite particular ways.
Yeah, in quite particular ways. So that's a slightly complicated point.
It's not... He doesn't really phrase it in terms of efficiency, but it's kind of... it's no more than is necessary. Certainly the way in which this essay is sort of framed within how people talk about architecture, it's kind of taken as read that this is taken up by modernism.
Corbe read it and liked it, yeah, and published it, as you said, and sort of ventriloquizes it in kind of ways, although he slightly tones it down.
But the essay is quite a lot more, it's a bit stranger.
It's stranger than Corbe. It's more fun to read. It's got a lot of the same sort of tendentious, bonkers statements, but it's all turned up a little bit.
Yeah, people really knew how to argue in those days. So shall we start off with the quotation that opens the essay? Because I think that...
Oh, yeah, another one. I'll try this one.
In the womb, the human embryo progresses through the same developmental stages as found in the animal kingdom. Upon birth, a human possesses the same sensory functions as a newborn dog. Through his childhood, he will go through all of the transformations found in the history of the human race. By age 2, he observes like a Papuan. By age 4, like a Teuton. At age 6, like Socrates. And at 8, like Voltaire. Once he is 8 years of age, he becomes conscious of the colour violet. The colour that was discovered in the 18th century.
He goes on to say that physicists are aware of colours in the spectrum, which we can't see at the moment, but future generations will be able to see.
He's got some funny ideas. That is a funny one. The aesthetic awakening.
Progress and development are a big part of how this argument is made.
This is a thought world which also has Hegel, Nietzsche, and Freud, although he doesn't necessarily agree with these people, but it's definitely got...
Darwin as well.
Darwin, yes. Darwin. We're progressing, and we will continue to progress to the point where we can see new colours, yeah. Soon.
But also that...
A dog is the same as a baby.
Is the same as, like, a person from 3,000 years ago is the same as... A person from a less developed part of the world in economic terms.
No, no, a dog is one step below. I mean, like, so a baby is like a dog and an infant is like a Papuan. And a Papuan slaughters his enemy and eats them, but is not a criminal.
Oh, yeah, well, we can kind of go on to that, don't we?
That's the next sentence.
Yeah, the next paragraph is sort of about... It's kind of important, isn't it? It's the sense that everything in the world can be understood as being at different stages of development, that you can kind of read and order everything in terms of how much it has progressed, how much it has become more advanced and better, and that you can read that, like, linear arrangement extends to animals, it extends backwards and forwards in time, and it extends across cultures.
Yeah, first
very
worm,
ambitious sort of flattening.
You know, then flatfish or whatever, then amphibian, and eventually Los.
Yeah, eventually the man in the jersey.
Yeah, the jerseys.
With his plain silver cigarette box, as we will see later on.
Do we want to do anything about who he is and where it is?
I guess having arrived at the present day, we could say what that is and how he's got there.
So this is just into the 20th century... Vienna, yeah. In the dual monarchy of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Yeah. Adolf Loos is a architect. He's born into a stonemason family, German in Moravia, moves to Vienna.
Well, I mean, his kind of early development is that he went to America for 3 years and worked, although there's not necessarily as an architect, but did come into contact with American architects and their work during his time there. His career in Vienna and elsewhere sort of starts after he's come back from that.
The two things he really likes is he really likes Louis Sullivan, he likes American informality, and he likes English formal men's clothing and dining habits, which is a really strange one.
That's a funny one, isn't it?
He likes roast beef and overcooked boiled vegetables.
Well, they're not meant to be that overcooked. I mean, I think the way he describes them, they're meant to be just cooked a little bit. Still sounds like rather a long time, but it's a lot less than you get in Mrs. Beaton, where it's like boil the cabbage for 3 hours or something.
Yeah. Consternation in the schoolyard with the advent of the new pressure cooker means that cabbage, formerly taking 5 hours to cook, now only took three. that's an aside.
So he's had that American experience. He comes back to Vienna and sets up as an architect, and then has a series of
we won't talk much I think about his architecture here, because we'll probably do it sometime. He's a very talented, if somewhat idiosyncratic, designer. He's sort of completely modernist in some ways, but also completely of the previous order. He is hard to simply and quickly characterize, I'd say.
So, I mean, his commissions are a mixture of, you know, things like shops and bars, relatively few larger buildings, and quite a lot of bourgeois villas of different sort of in the suburbs and in various cities around. And yeah, they're very interesting. He has a distinctive approach to space planning, which he calls realm plan, in which the room spaces the divisions between rooms do not entirely dissolve, as in kind of Corbusian free plan, into sort of a grid and an arrangement of elements, but are certainly softened. There are lots of interesting connections between them, and the whole is destabilized by lots of shifts in section. So things are moving up and down, and there are these strange and interesting routes between them. I think he must have been a little bit influenced by English free building. And
Absolutely. Spoke to New Mathesius. And really, they're a sort of period of they're not the only people doing this. I would say he is the most talented designer, though, doing this. It's actually very difficult to make a lot of this stuff work when you're moving up the floor level up and down all the time. It becomes quite a challenge. He's a real master of the, like, really tiny staircase, the funny tight turn and the room that opens out to another room. I think Pliny would have really liked it.
It's views through.
Lots of views through. There's lots of closing and opening.
Maybe we could just give a kind of an example which relates both to the essay that we're discussing and also to this ambiguous position that he has vis-a-vis modernism and the architecture which came before it. So in something which he often does, things are very, very stripped back. They're very, very abstract, but nevertheless in a room there will often be a kind of a dado sort of datum coming halfway up the wall, which may be clad below with a highly figured stone, as in his famous late villa, the Villa Müller in Prague. So in one sense, the detail has been stripped back to this very, very abstract level, but the innate quality of the material still creates this kind of highly decorative effect, and that is in the way in which that like dado datum is set up, something which seems extremely historicist, even if in a very abstract way.
It's very strange, because I mean, it's not necessarily a dado. It can be that there will be like an alcove, which is entirely a different material. One thing that's characteristic of his material palette is it mixes, frankly, sort of louche, like curvaceous black polished granite, quarter cut marble, and the ascetic. There's a lot of white rendered, sharp arist sort of cuboidal blocky things. It's also worth remembering, this is earlier. Korb existed in a world where there was a modernist avant-garde. He didn't. He lived in a world where the avant-garde was Art Nouveau, and it wasn't crisp and cuboidal, really. I mean, there was a little bit, not very much, though, at all, in the late 19th century, which is what we're talking about. When he's starting off, it's the 1890s.
Yeah, and this is written in 1908, the essay. In terms of Corbusier's timeline, he's still building these sort of gingerbread houses in the Swiss mountains at this point.
And he's young. I mean, I think he's... Loos is, 20 years older, maybe a little less. But that's a very important 20 years. The context of the writing of the essay was his biggest commission. It's now the Raiffeisen Bank in Vienna. But for then, it was a mixed-use building, tailoring school. And it's on a corner of is it St. Michael's Square? It's a very prominent site, corner building, opposite a bit of the Hofburg, I think. This is the sort of thing I could have looked up beforehand, isn't it? I'm doing this from memory.
Now known as the Loos House, though.
Now known as the Loos House or the Raiffeisen Bank, rather more prosaically. The proposal was, looks to us now, very moderate, but at the time was extremely radical in that the bottom bit is this green marble, very stripped back, sort of classicism, sort of he's taken Schinkel and like stripped it back even a lot further and made it a bit more strange in the way that Behrens would do. And the top of it is white rendered, and he wanted it to be completely devoid of any features other than this grid of windows, which are also very bare. And then on the very top, there's a bronze roof. And he couldn't, for a long time, get permission to build it. That was a long argument. And eventually they relented as long as he put window boxes with geraniums on some of the windows to soften it up a little bit. Franz Josef? Was it? No, Franz... What was the name of the emperor?
The emperor, yeah, Franz Josef.
Franz Josef boarded up the windows of the Hofburg Palace so that this building could not be viewed from the inside.
Excellent. Oh, well, he didn't have to look at it for very long. Naturally, like 10 years or something. But
I think he died in 1917, didn't he? That's interesting. The Austro-Hungarian Empire is an interesting history, and it's an interesting place to read about.
Yeah, definitely.
And then he wrote a series of essays, of which this is one, published them. I would make an aside point that I think he's one of the first architects to really understand mass media as a propaganda tool, which is something I think Korb we credited with being a really good early proponent of the mass media. So's Loos, and he's before, and he's publishing lots of books and even more mad essays than that. I haven't been able to... Lots of them haven't been translated and are slightly hard to get hold of, but just the titles of them are quite extraordinary.
He's positioning himself as this as the like avatar of the future, isn't he? He's saying, come on, this is where we're going.
Man. And the future man is like, he's an evolutionary step forward. Yeah. He wears jersey like fabrics. It's very stretchy, but is also always impeccably dressed for his conditions. Clothing is extremely important. Losis books, by the way, sold the book on male grooming sold very well, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he may have been very natty. It's interesting to, yeah, so he did also, he had a journal and things. So in his career, in all sorts of ways, mirrors Corbusier's early one, certainly.
But it's also very different and very, he's a strange, conflicted person. And if you're going to tell the sort of first order story of Le Corbusier, it's quite simple. You say, like, father of modernism, blah, blah, blah. And the reality is much more complex than that. But even getting a kind of coherent first story for Loos is difficult because he seems like such a, so contradictory.
The rate of cultural development is held back by those that cannot cope with the present. I live in the year 1908, but my neighbour lives approximately in the year 1900, and one over there lives in the year 1880. It is a misfortune for any government if the culture of its people is dominated by the past. The farmer from Kals lives in the 12th century, and on the occasion of the Jubilee procession, tribes walked past which, even during the period of mass migration, were thought to be backward. Happy is the country which does not have such backward-looking inhabitants. Happy is America.
Yeah, so he'd been to America. Like, if people don't know, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was extraordinary. In the on a rail network, you know, within an hour you could go from, like, extremely modern urban condition, albeit extraordinarily overdressed.
Yeah, it's one of the picturesque things about the Austro-Hungarian Empire is that everyone has military rank, even like accountants or surveyors or
Russia,
like professionals. So any kind of profession,
only in the civil service. Yeah. In the civil service, so everyone in the civil service has a military rank, which was true in the authoritarian empires in general. If you've read Gogol's The Nose, one of the key denouements is he's found the nose and he's like, I'm going to get my nose back. And then he discovers that the nose is two ranks above him in the civil service. And then he just retreats in terrible embarrassment because he can't
talk to him. Yeah.
Because he can't get his nose back because he's, yeah. So it's like that, yeah. And they all wear, yeah, their epaulettes and medal, you know, so you're, the tax clerk wears his epaulettes and medals and double-breasted suit and serge trousers and all that sort of stuff. And it's completely mad. And, yeah, once they've got, you know, Vienna, but also lots of industrial cities around which are producing, you know, precision engineering and the future. And then you go out and suddenly it really is like the 12th century, you know, the workers' hovels with homespun clothing and tamped earth floors. And the empire was, you know, going through the Carpathian Mountains and through Bosnia and really much more diverse than we think of as existing anymore.
A lot of this extraordinary patchwork was kind of scoured away during the Second World War, but it was
And the cities were mixed, so I don't know how you pronounce it, Brno? How do you pronounce this?
Brno or something.
Brno's where he was born, which I think the centre of was largely German, and he was German, as in German speaking. But there would have been all sorts of, and the cities were like that. They were a smattering. The empire had been until 1848 controlled by Germans, and then there's the big uprising where the Hungarians want to break away, and then they get, and it becomes a dual monarchy. There's all sorts of class, and there's a lot of hierarchy.
Something I want to throw in, which I think is important, and so this is a polemic, and it is an important part of the context, that as with many polemics, actually the most hated, the like figure, the biggest target is not necessarily the forces of reaction, but the forces of the last avant-garde, or the kind of existing avant-garde which he wants to overtake. And those are the forces of the Vienna secession. So he does call out Josep Maria Olbrich, and does he mention Henry van der Velde, who's a sort of allied?
Not in this one, but he talks about him, and also he writes polemics which are just entirely against Hoffman.
So then these are these, I mean, we've referred to, I think we've talked about them in other episodes, but it's, yeah, it's this kind of Art Nouveau style. It's very lush. It's very figured. It has these flowing lines.
Patterned wallpaper. Their buildings are quite nice, but we don't talk about them anymore because they're not very...
The art's still popular, though. People like it. It's gold.
Something about that statement with the periods is it's a very different formulation, but the same thing as the future is here, only unevenly distributed. Except his phrasing is like, some people are in the present and some people are in the dark ages, yeah. Which was definitely true in his day. And actually, I think really is a more accurate representation of what that statement is. I think that's a better formulation, which is that some people are in the present and some people are not. The present is here, but some people are stuck.
I don't know if this is the right place to do it, but he writes this very funny sketch against the architects of the Vienna secession. It's this from this essay called The Story of a Poor Rich Man. Once it happened that he was celebrating his birthday. His wife and children had given him many presents. He liked their choice immensely and enjoyed it all thoroughly. But soon the architect arrived to set things right and to take all the decisions in difficult questions. The master greeted him with pleasure, for he had much on his mind. But the architect did not see the man's joy. "What kind of slippers are these you've got on?" he ejaculated painfully. The master of the house looked at his embroidered slippers. Then he breathed in relief. This time he felt quite guiltless. The slippers had been made to the architect's original designs. So he answered, in a superior way, "But, Mr. Architect, have you already forgotten? You yourself designed them." "Of course," thundered the architect, "but for the bedroom. They completely disrupt the mood here with these two impossible spots of colour. Can't you see that?"
The thing is, that could be a satire on himself. A man who literally devoted an entire book to what variety of clothing you should wear in what circumstance. It is impossible to wear a checked shirt to the opera, which he regarded as a timeless condition.
The person he's mocking there is Henry van der Velde, who actually had done a house for a rich guy and then had also designed suitable clothing for different rooms.
Oh yeah, architects are always doing this sort of thing, aren't they? One thing he says is that, you know, as man becomes more developed, he loses his taste for ornament, and it's not because he's repressing it. It just sloughs away, and if you have a taste for ornament, you're probably like halfway between a cannibal and a modern person.
Do you want to do? I mean, we've given people enough warning now. We can do one of the super racist quotes.
A child is immoral. For us, the Papuan too. The Papuan slaughters his enemies and eats them. He is not a criminal. The modern man slaughters another man and eats him. He is a criminal or a degenerate. The Papuan tattoos his skin, his boat, his paddles, and anything he can lay his hands on. He is not a criminal. A modern man, though, who tattoos himself, is either a criminal or a degenerate. In prisons, 80% of the inmates bear tattoos. Tattooed men who are not imprisoned are either latent criminals or degenerate aristocrats. If a tattooed man dies in freedom, it is because he has died prematurely before committing his murder.
Yeah, that's a bit... I like
it's
that
good.
Bit. It's good, yes. Oh, dear. If only he could see hipster
I'm
society.
Not sure anything in East London would change his mind.
Yeah, well, the great winnowing, the great murder spree is on its way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he sort of goes on, you know. There's another really one I love. God, where is it? About lavatories.
Oh, yes.
Well, yeah. It is obvious that people with such degenerative symptoms will be attacked by such a compulsion in rooms dedicated to cleanliness. The lavatory. So this is, you know, the urge to decorate.
Yeah, I think he has a sort of a theory that obviously also the most degenerate people are attracted to these spaces. So,
but they're also rebelling against the cleanliness of the lavatory. One can measure the culture of a society by the amount of graffiti covering the lavatory walls. It is a natural phenomenon that the first artistic expression a child to scribble erotic symbols on the wall, and so on and so forth. But what An erotic symbol for him is a bit strange. All art is erotic. The first erotic ornament, that came into being, the cross, had an erotic origin. The horizontal line, the reclining woman. The vertical line, the man penetrating her.
There's a very strong subtext, which I guess you're probably picking up here, which I think is a big component of what's going on with Loos as a figure and as a designer. And he's in the city of Freud. There's an awful lot of is it sublimated? I guess it's a tiny bit sublimated, but it's kind of a rather imperfectly sublimated sexuality that's in evidence here. He was a horny guy. I mean, even before we get on to his own later in life degeneracy, a lot of his projects are strongly coloured by this erotic quality. So,
if you like a sort of oval black granite bathroom with a bath on a pedestal, or lining your wife's bedroom entirely in fur.
Yeah, white mink. Or he did a
floor walls.
Or he did also. He designed a house for Josephine Baker, the dancer, who
we haven't gotten to call perving over her.
No, but she becomes like a kind of universal erotic fixation for modernist architects and artists of the time. They're all obsessed with her.
So it's a banana dance. It's a good modernist fruit. The banana, you know. See, you know. De Curico painting, naked female torso, rubber glove with nail through it, and bunch of bananas.
He's kind of also obsessed with degeneracy.
This sort of version of Freudianism is, although I don't think he would have gone along with Freud, he probably disagreed with him, but it's the same, it's like replacing Catholic guilt, isn't it? It's like, instead of confession and self-analysis through the church, you explain all your thoughts through repressed sexuality and your dreams and all that sort of, you know, all the things that would be religiously interpreted.
I feel like there's a kind of an analogy somewhere. There's something which he's doing in his architecture. There's something about this, as you say, this like combination of lushness or looseness and asceticism in the material, or even in the treatment of particular materials. So you take an incredibly rich material and then you apply it in this very austere kind of detail, which is a kind of an analogy of sublimation, or of something which is pent up, isn't it? The materials which he goes for are not simply sort of decorative and attractive, but they're like incredibly intense, and they're intensified by their treatment as well. They're intensified by everything else being stripped away. There's something there which feels like it's about taking something incredibly powerful and then restraining it.
But also he does understand hierarchy. The houses have cozy bits. There's a lot of inglenooks and, you know, little nice little things that can be, you know. It's not all polished black granite. There's a lot of caramel-coloured plywood and sliding doors. And
the bathroom, like the black granite bathroom is pretty amazing,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, but that's pure kink. It's not all pure kink.
No. But it's notable that the bathroom is so kinky. It's like... Because it's so much black granite, and it's also got these. Has it got some columns in it? Doesn't it? It has this sort of.
I'm not sure for pervy interiors he's ever really been beat by a quality architect.
There's the black marble, and then there's the columns, and it's this incredibly like intense, almost funerary character.
And also, you sort of step up this tiny little constriction into it.
Yeah, this constraint, then the kind of sacrilege of putting the bath on the kind of altar-like pedestal as well.
Yeah.
It's very intense. It's very intense. I think that's a huge part of the...
It's good sort of sacrificing altar.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things which is going on in the essay.
It goes through all of his work. He's, but also... Like a depressing, I don't know.
Oh, well, so we should tell the story. One of the kind of the culmination of all of this is that in sort of semi-retirement, he seems to have taken up with doing a bit of child sex abuse.
No, he was doing it all the way through, I think. Yeah. And his wife's always the same. He married three times and they were always the same age. And they were always like very young looking, like they were 20 or 18 or whatever, or 17, but they looked like they were 15, including the last one, who I think was like 30 years younger than him. he definitely, his sexual preference was definitely for girls as young as possible.
Yeah. He's an extremely reprehensible character. You just have to decide whether you can still be interested in the work. I think that we definitely can, but it's not to excuse any of it. It's a little bit difficult because one of the things which makes the work really fascinating is how charged it is with the erotic.
It's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because, you know, if you're going to talk about like Speer or something, who killed tens of thousands of people and should have been hanged, that actually doesn't... Like, he wasn't killing them... The architecture is not about killing people. It's about other things. Whereas a lot of the architecture in Loos... Well, one of the things that's interesting is the sexuality.
Yeah.
So although the crime is rather less than killing tens of thousands of people, although pretty damn reprehensible...
Yeah, it's sort of technically separable, but it's sort of still very close at hand.
It's highly entangled. Yeah.
It's, so anyway, that, I think, has to be said... So he did get caught, but he wasn't really punished for it in any way, and it was sort of shortly before he died. Did he go to prison?
He wasn't in semi-retirement. What happened was he got done for getting like working class girls to be life models for him and touching them up, I think. Like, he was charged, although acquitted with being a bit worse than that. He did 4 months in jail, and that was what brought about the retirement. Because although society was probably more tolerant of that, I think being actually going to prison for being a paedophile probably was enough to dampen down your career somewhat then.
Mm.
And there's been a lot of allegations about, you know, whether or not he got lenient treatment or how bad or not bad what he actually did was. I don't know. I haven't looked into it closely enough. It seems
quite bad.
He was somewhere on the spectrum between... he was definitely attracted to young girls, and he was somewhere between, like light sexual assault and full-on paedophile rapist.
Yeah.
It's not really a great spectrum to be on. It's a bit difficult to talk about, like, maintaining sort of basic, you know, in a way that isn't going to... push the limit of decency rather too far, isn't it? We haven't looked into it enough to form a strong opinion about where on that, but yeah, it's fundamentally, it doesn't look very good for him.
Yeah, well, it has to be said, doesn't it? I think maybe it would be good. Do we want to do another quotation? Do we have another good bit to pick out? Or
yeah, I don't think we've done enough on,
because I would like to talk about why is this happening.
Why does he think this?
Why does he think this? What's been going on? Why, like, how does he feel able to assert this? I think something which we missed is that he's slightly channeling Louis Sullivan here.
He's really into it. Form follows function.
And Sullivan had also said that he has some quote about how it would be better if people essentially focused on the primary form of the buildings which they're designing rather than how they're going to be ornamented, or words to that effect.
And, like, although Luz does less ornament than Sullivan, he does do some, and he doesn't disapprove of it absolutely.
Yeah, no, some of his buildings are incredibly ornamented. There's the... can't remember what I'm talking about. But there's that amazing portal, which I think was for the Chicago Expo, which is, like, this incredibly... It's very in very relatively sort of flat relief, but it's very, very dense... Densely sort of ornamented and shifting and kind of
like
fantastic.
There's literally like stucco friezes and things in his project. You know, there's like full on classical ornament, just not as much.
So maybe we could do one of these strange economic quotations, because I think that might.
Korb, he does slightly, although they're slightly more rational than Korb, but essentially tendentious mock science.
Well, maybe we should summarise it. So he has this kind of economic objection to ornament, which is a bit tangled. Part of it is an objection to waste and the amount of time that it takes to do it compared with making something plain and unadorned. And then he says that some people have made the argument that it's good because that creates work and therefore wealth. And he says that, well, if that's true, why don't we just burn the whole city down so that we can rebuild it, which will make us all much wealthier?
Yeah, yeah. And he also says, you know, things that are ornamented and things that are unornamented will sell for exactly the same amount. And so all of the extra difference is wasted and should just go to the worker. Yeah. It's not completely true. I'm not sure he doesn't understand economics, but that's fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's sort of, I think he is to some extent making a distinction as well between a designer asking someone to make something which is ornamented, which he holds to be utterly reprehensible, and a craftsman like a shoemaker doing a bit of ornament themselves when they make a pair of shoes and they add some sort of dots and things on pattern the leather, which he kind of hold, he sort of thinks is acceptable and is a kind of license which we might grant them as a poor benighted person.
Well, I think part of his theory of dressing is appropriateness, right? If you're you know, the great complaint about Sherlock Holmes is that he is depicted as wearing a deerstalker in the city, which obviously he never did. You wear a deerstalker when you're stalking deers out in the country. But, you know, if something terrible happens in the country, you then... Or you know, clothing must be appropriate. I think the appropriateness of the ornamentation... I think he has a theory, but I think it... Or no, I think the thing is he doesn't have a universal theory, actually.
Well, as he said, not everyone is living in the present day, are they? So it may be that some artisans are not yet...
They're still semi-savage, but not none the worse for
we
it.
We shouldn't persecute them, but if a professional insists on ornamenting things, then he must be...
Then he is degenerate.
He is a degenerate aristocrat or...
he's a degenerate rather than someone who's never generated in the first place.
Toilet wall drawer.
Yeah, schooler. Yeah. But he's not a child. That's why he's atavistic. Yeah.
I love the bit about... Like, there are bits in this which I just love. I love the bit about the tattoos. Anyone who has tattoos...
Anyone who has tattoos, who is not in prison, he completely neglects the possibility that they might get away with it.
Yeah, they will inevitably commit a murder.
Yes, and if they haven't committed a murder, it's just because they have died too soon. This was the time of the first great sort of aristocratic tattoo phase, I think.
Oh, really? Okay.
So... Yeah, certainly in England.
Well, he does talk about them as degenerate aristocrats, doesn't he? So I think that must be, yeah.
Didn't Edward get a tattoo? Prince of Wales? A lot of aristocrats at the time were, yeah. I think because it was transgressive and their lives must have been very boring.
What did he get?
There was a woman in London who did aristocrat tattoos.
Oh, right.
I met the person who wrote her biography for the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography.
Good. Well, I'm glad someone has done that.
They write a lot of biographies for that thing.
Yeah, I think that what's going on, though, is that he is making a connection to the economic context as being part of what's changed in ornament. Because I think that this isn't something which is just happening in his head. However problematic we might find his particular formulation, he's identifying a real crisis in culture, which is that the status of ornament is changing, and it's changing because of industrialized production. Actually, he's way off in a sense, because one of the reasons it's changing is that it's no longer really scarce, that it's something which can be mass produced.
Ornament has always been... Ornament being something that deals with surface and often repetition is extremely amenable to mass production. So, in fact, a lot of the first things that are mass produced are ornaments. If you think of, like, the idols in, you know, the cult things in ancient Egypt, or that they were churned out by the thousands, or the little saints... metal tags if you went to fountains or you know, pilgrimage.
At the same time, in architecture, ornament is something which is, you know, the scale from ornament, from sort of rusticity and simplicity to ornament, signifying luxury, wealth, richness.
Yeah, the first thing you do is you build a stone wall and then you carve it. And carving probably costs more than the building. And it is a demonstration of, you know, those glittering suits of armour with all the fiddly detail, which costs far more than the... is a demonstration of wealth and status symbol, which ornament still is. I mean, embroidered clothing and stuff is still kind of features in very expensive fashion. You still get things... People still prize the thing where someone has spent an inordinately large amount of time on some sort of pretty menial decorative task.
But they have to have really spent the time.
Yeah. Whereas if it's been done by a robot, it immediately... people don't like it.
And that is something which I think that the key term to introduce here is the idea of something being kitsch, which is also sort of flying around at the time, which I think captures this sense of that something is kitsch when it aspires to be fine and it aspires to be luxurious and it aspires to be meaningful as well. And it kind of fails in those. I think that kitschness is connected to...
Well, it's also just that it's cheap.
Well, its cheapness is a part of that, isn't it? And it's also... Bathos is an important part of what makes something kitsch.
My love, like these flowers, will never fade on the side of a plastic box of some.
That's super kitsch. But, like, something which is cheap and utilitarian isn't kitsch because it's simple. The kitschness comes from it, from the attempt to... And something can actually be still expensive and kitsch.
Yeah, there's a really funny fringe, isn't there, between is it kitsch? I mean, it might be the real thing. Is that, you know, Venetian glass chandelier kitsch? Well,
might be.
Probably.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's bad. But it's also to do with snobbery, isn't it? And to do with...
Sure.
And to do with the rising middle class, right? It's to do with that irritating class which can neither be patronised or pitied.
But I think that it's important that, you know, when Princess Alexandra built, like, an enormous Baroque palace in St. Petersburg and literally covered the entire inside of it in gold, everyone was astonished. That was an astonishing thing. But if you do that in the contemporary period, or even actually, you know, to an extent earlier, you're Donald Trump, you know, you're someone who's sort of misunderstood how to really connote, like, luxury and or not even luxury, but like taste or any of these things, that in an age where it's actually easy to like roll out the carpet of all of these previous signifiers of richness or
there had been massive ornamental inflation, right? Prior to that point, like, every building that was going up in central Vienna, the thing that was shocking about the Lotus is it wasn't covered in sub-Baroque decoration. Because every other building was. Can you imagine the city where... I mean, they were all still being carved by hand. But can you imagine the city where, like, a building is being built in the centre, it has to be covered in Baroque swags. Hand-carved Baroque swags. That is just... Like, you just can't get planning permission, and no one would want it anyway. Every block of flats has to look like the Hofburg.
But it had got... Yeah. I mean, even though it's hand-carved, it's got cheaper because you just have enormous yards of people turning them out.
You can... Transport's much better and the tools are much better and you've got a lot more agricultural surplus. Yeah, everything's got a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
It's funny. I think, actually...
I just think it's an important part of what's going on in this essay is that ornament is devalued by becoming like cheap and ubiquitous.
Well, he doesn't ever say that. In fact, he says the opposite. He says what happens is a man advances and he completely loses his taste for ornament.
The way that he makes an argument is often about like casting around for justifications for something which he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't really have an analysis.
The thing is, his buildings are really expensive and really labor intensive, as your oval polished black granite will won't to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't feel like that argument is made with any like great conviction, actually.
No, and also he's absolutely not against sort of architectural fakery. He's not structural truth.
No.
To be honest, anyone who is a bit moronic. It's a teenage position. But there's lots of there's fakery in his projects in that sense. The columns in the front of the Lowe's house don't bear any weight. They're decorative.
Well, I mean, because he did talk, and actually I think this was a quote we had at the beginning, that people being sad because they feel that the age no longer has a style, a distinctive style, or that style, that people have become, they've become aware of the kind of artificiality. I mean, actually the time was full of styles of different kinds, but they were all kind of copies or throwbacks or revivals of different kinds.
If you look at Louis Sullivan...
Yeah, but Louis, you know, he built a certain amount, but that's not... Most people were not building like that.
No, it's true. I think Hegelian sort of understanding of the zeitgeist would have been in the intellectual environment that he was in.
that's what people must mean when he's saying, oh, people complain that we're incapable of creating a style. It's because they become aware that all of the sort of stylistic ornament that they're surrounded with is imitative. It's like just sort of doing different historical epochs as different flavours.
A copy of a copy of a copy of a copy, as Ayn Rand would say. But later on in his career, I think he, like Mathesius and Lutyens and others, would make that attack on functionalist modernists, that they really are just, they're talking big, but they're just another style.
In the sort of modernism that comes after this, yeah, people sort of say that they're not really doing ornament, but in a way, that's just because it's a particular style of architecture in which the communicative role played by ornament traditionally is instead expressed by elements. So it's expressed by a particular way of doing columns or a particular way of doing the plan, which is expressive of these values of futurity and industrial production and the kind of valor, the sort of borrowed valor of machine age objects, and these sorts of things. So in a sense, it's doing what ornament does. I think that people maybe, something which is distinct about ornament in the more elaborate, like Beaux-Arts kind of way, is that certainly ornament as it within those sorts of styles is a, something which is not necessarily more communicative, but it's something where the manner of communication is much more susceptible to a kind of codification and to a sort of semantic like codification. So you can say, you know, these different bits of the classical language express this, that, and the other. They express force in this way. They express like masculinity or femininity, or they refer to a concept of the civic. This bit here refers to a concept of the civic in particular. This column in its relation to the outside and the inside space. When it sort of comes back in the post-war, maybe it's part of the attraction of it is that sort of ideological, that kind of ideological potential, or that sort of the chance to sort of to play kind of fun games with ideology.
In a modernistic language, if it has what you could call ornament, it's much less literal. Like the ornament in Beaux-Arts is literally like manufactured profiles that you stick on. That goes away. Lowe still uses manufactured profiles, chops them up and sticks them around, and he sort of plays around with them. He's still in that world, even though he's criticising it. I'd say he's still completely in that world. I don't know at all what it means in the avant-garde. There's always been a lot of ornament going on in production architecture, in building, in the UK. I'm not sure there was an enormous return in the UK. The reason I say in the UK is because it's just what I know about. I mean, in the domestic interior, there was always loads of ornament. But, I mean, if you think about, like, the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was an awful lot of, like, patterned tiles and textured wallpaper and stuff. In a way, we're at the nadir of that. In a way, like...
Yeah, but it's important that that's something which is individual, generally, rather than... It's, like, actually, ornament is something that you do to your own home, which I think is reflective of a place that it has within the kind of consumer culture of that era. You sort of, the way in which you define yourself is by ornamenting your house.
Your Avocado bathroom suite.
Yeah. You get your purple sink and like various applied decorations to the outside of the utilitarian exterior. What does ornament mean now? I think is one of the things which I'm slightly wrestling with, because I think
it really becomes a issue of meanings.
Yeah,
like what the word means. The thing that it used to refer to doesn't really exist in the same way. And it died in because of international modernism. Now, you can take various aspects of what that was, and they continue. You know, basically all the elements of what it was continue, but not in... The particular thing that he refers to as ornament has ceased to be.
Nevertheless, I think it constructs the way that people think about it now. So you do have people in contemporary architecture who are interested in like... ornament of different kinds. There was
Cruces and John do it not very successfully. Some of it is good.
I think that at its best it is possessed of a kind of Locean, strange sort of sublimation of kink. You know, the like lacy things blown up to enormous concrete things. They're doing a building in Zurich for as this like ice hockey stadium, and it has these very delicate, rather twee, like curtainy reliefs, except they're enormous.
Yeah,
like they're massive and they're scaled to the scale of like the motorway next to them. That's, and it becomes quite weird. Yeah, so there's someone doing it. I mean, I think that I've read an essay where someone is essentially responding to this, like the racism of the way in which this essay is put together, but essentially in a way which is meant to frame Ornament as now being kind of woke. Like, Ornament is how architecture talks about a diverse society, which seems to me to be a very bad idea on all kinds of levels. But
you can cut all this out. What the hell are they talking about?
I think what they mean is they want to gratify themselves and like do things which they think are pretty.
You know, like the community art project where everyone like makes an impression on a tile and they're all fired and stuck on something?
No, because it's just the architect doing all of that. Yeah, like the valor assigned to super over decorated kind of kitschy stuff is that is emblematic of like non-monolithic, non-monocultural.
Germany has had to work out what to do with all the very ornamented militarist buildings, which are not necessarily a sign of a super diverse society. Either a really decorated classical thing could be any of the ideologies, and so can a corporate, and so can a not black Mesian obelisk.
No, I mean, that's certainly true. I do think that the ornament is attractive to people because it works as a carrier of ideology, because there's no sort of universal language of ornament. But what's good about it is that it's very flexible and you can apply it to all sorts of different buildings and arrangements and just dress them so that so it's very flexible. It's a very kind of adaptable strategy.
Sure. But what I was saying is that I think the relationship between them is something which you have to establish. You establish relationship between a politics and a style, and then it means that. But it doesn't mean it to start with.
And it's all kind of relational as well. So like the reason like the Prussians get super into Greek stuff is that the French are Roman.
Yeah, but it's also the Spartans had such a jolly good time. I mean, the Romans can be democracy or the Greeks can be democracy. It's your choice. And the Romans can be fascism and the Greeks can be fascism. It's totally up to you. I mean, they were both pretty... The past is full of absolutely horrible things.
What makes something ornament is that it's not elemental.
It's surface, not substance. Yeah. It's not substantial.
It's surfacial. It's, yeah.
Is that the word? Surfacial.
Yeah, and it's not really, it's not really spatial either. Like, it sort of leaves, it can do things like camouflage transitions and things like that. Yeah. But it's not really in and of itself, like, something of a spatial character.
It can affect light and weight and things, but by affecting, it acts through acting on the effect and the perceived materiality or something, doesn't it? The action is not through, you've got the primary materiality and then you can make that light or airy or diaphanous or robust or feel heavy or light or using surface treatment.
So when I read the essay, one of the things which I find really fascinating about it is that it brings together so many things which are changing in this revolutionary age which he's moving into, and that it's not simply that architectural culture is in the process of this enormous shift, but it's surrounded by and alluding to an economic transformation, to a transformation in the structure of production, in the culture of cities as well, and that, but also in its curious sort of sexual fascination, I think that it also points towards a transformation of subjectivity and what it's like to be a person in this age as well, that someone in the 20th century is not constructed in the same way as a person from earlier, that through the transformation of their material, social and economic circumstances, they've also become transformed as subjects. And one of the things which you sort of hear kind of rattling around in here is the sort of anguish of that change. The other thing which I think needs to be said is to sort of take the other end of it, which is to say, well, yeah, it's been rattling around all those years, but then where does it leave us now? in some ways, I think it has been successful. Like, it is quite difficult to talk about ornament, or it feels still quite transgressive.
But my theory is that's because ornament, as it was then, I don't think it was killed by modernism. Yeah. I think it died.
So what did it mean then? So that was ornament as in a particular and natural way of elaborating details, which had all sorts of different modes and different sorts of expressions, but which wasn't really... So in the contemporary context, you might well add what you might think of as ornament to a building, but what you would be doing is taking something which you see to have like an entirely natural way of being articulated, a kind of neutral way of being articulated, and then sticking something onto it. And in some sense, actually doing ornament in the way that people in previous ages did ornament is not like that. The articulation of the form and then the application of the ornament are part of the same process in a way that's inseparable. Is that sort of what you mean? And so is that what's died?
That's an element. I haven't totally disentangled it, but part of it is definitely that you can no longer do ornament in the same way, because to do ornament then is totally natural. It sounds transgressive now because it is transgressive, because you are transgressing something in order to do it.
Yeah, and it's performative now in a way that in a sense it wasn't then.
And it's performative and sort of stupid.
But in that sense, it then becomes wrapped up in this particular, like, post-ideological way of doing architectural ideology. It was normalised because it was part of culture, so there was no sort of cultural break. But also it was kind of unfeigned in the people who were designing and making it. Whereas today, when you do it, it's sort of to try and make a point, and it's often coded as a sort of kind of semi-linguistic, you know, it's a way of trying to make the building say something.
But that had been around before, right? So the Gothic Revival is very much about spreading coded messages, isn't it? But now that I think about it, so you've got late modernism, right? And everyone's like, these are all a bit boring. It was my experience of looking at all of the council houses. Interesting thinking, tasteful decisions, good politics, bit boring. And then you get various, so you get, we're going to really express the concrete and go down brutalism. Yeah. You get high tech, which is about ornamentation. It's like,
it's sort of about a lot of things, but
one of the things is you can put more and more and more widgets on the facades.
Yeah. Those sort of cable ties,
little cast stainless steel, like, you know, the things for holding in the glazing panels, lots and lots of metal things, and then all your pipes, and it's all essentially...
Yeah, well, it's a sort of a way to do... It's a way to do ornament within, or within the kind of mythos of, like, functionalism, is just take all the services and needlessly elaborate them and stick them on the outside.
Yeah, and then needlessly elaborate the attachments, and then needlessly... And then there's that strain, and there's the other strain of sort of... we don't really need to talk about postmodernism. That's the way they deal with ornament is obvious. And then there's parametricism, which is all about ornament as well. It's all about making...
But it's not really... I'm not sure... I think that there's a difference between ornament and, like, Baroque space.
Yeah, but they also do it at the small scale sometimes. Yeah. You know, the sort of cast component that is repeated.
Yeah, and it is a component. And although I remember, I think, is it Farshid Mousavi from Foreign Office, as was, like 10 years ago. But she did a book about ornament. I think she did a book about ornament, but it was very much within the particular ideological frame of the moment, was this idea of architecture as affective. So in a sense, like non-linguistic, it just sort of acts upon you without you really thinking about it in different ways, and trying to strip out all of the semiotics and the kind of the sort of mediation and interpretation that had been going on, and but still have a kind of ornament which is still exists in that kind of world.
And their stuff was pretty ornamental. Lots of like ornamental facades, right?
Yeah, well, and lots then, of like fritted glass and
yeah,
stuff.
And then you think, okay, so let me think about the architecture schools that I knew. They're all pretty if you just want to look at them and think ornamental or not, sure, okay, maybe some of parametricism isn't very ornamental. Like the product of the Bartlett are ornaments and are encrusted.
Yeah, well, there are lots of different strains now, aren't there? Because there is the Pomo Redux kind of thing of little arches and bright colours and things.
Yeah, but also it's like really about like producing ornamental objects and finishes and also about ornamental craft. But it often has a narrative on top of it of like either functionalism or collage or
yeah,
quotation.
And I think that it's important that, you know, Loos makes a distinction, and I think it's one worth making between like a richness or a kind of inherently figured material. And that might be one produced by process. But ornament is something slightly different because it's like designed to look a particular way. So, I don't think you could call the concrete finish of the Barbican Centre ornamental, really. I think that would be a slight abuse of language to say that was an ornament.
Kind of. I mean, it is actually. It's actually someone making aesthetic decisions all the way through. It's like rustication. I think, again, what we're discovering is what we knew already, which is that, in a sense, depending on how you define ornament, depending on which strain you look at, it's either everywhere and basically unavoidable, or it died in that time because that meaning is part of the zeitgeist that he was in. And that, but I think it's an irresolvable thing, because really it's a problem of what it is you mean. Architecture is never going to escape doing things to surfaces to make them look away. It's always going to be vulnerable to aesthetic analysis or that sort of thing. People do from time to time say that decisions in architecture are not aesthetic, but they're not right. Not all decisions are aesthetic, but that's always a big component. And once you've said that's aesthetic, you're going to use tools, aren't you?
Yeah.
And they will exist within their culture, but the tool of surface, you're not going to get rid of it. So in some sense, there will always be dancing around something which is sort of ornament. But ornament also is a product of a particular time and space. And this sort of industrial ornament is a different, slightly different thing to the pre-industrial ornament. But
yeah, at a particular kind of continuity of meaning, which has definitely been cut off. And that's okay. It's nice to live in the future.
Well, that's Hegel's insight. The zeitgeist moves on. You can't create the artwork of the previous era. It's moved. The spirit of the time. Historicism isn't recreating the past. It's making a new future.
Yeah.
Because no matter what you do, you make a new future.
Yeah, it's making a new future, and it's also...
No man steps into the same river twice. Is that Thales, or is that...
It's Heraclitus.
Heraclitus,
it is. He has like a particular phrase.
Oh.
Pantarei. Yeah. Well, there's lots more we could talk about, but maybe we'll just leave it.
Yeah.
I did want to talk about CNC, but fuck it, you know.
I think people know. I think that'll be on the horizon anyway.
Yeah, okay. We'll be in the future before very long, and we won't forever
all of the past's futures, right? That's wonderful. Yeah.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. Thanks very much for listening.
I wonder how that will come out in the cut.
Yeah, I wonder. I think there's bits and pieces of interest in there.
Yeah.
Read
the essay. It's very easily available.
Yeah, if you can Google for it, they're all over the place. Tell us what you think. Send us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
We haven't had any recently. Very bad. We haven't. The email address is
aboutbuildingsandcities@gmail.com.
We haven't had an email for ages.
We get some spam.
Except for one offering exciting new potentials.
And what else?
Review us.
You can review us on
wherever
iTunes.
You like.
It's very.
If you do it on iTunes, we'll read it as long as you're in.
We can just keep changing countries.
I keep checking the countries, but perhaps I'm not very good. Come on, lots of countries. Lots of countries, we have listeners and no one's reviewed at all.
Yeah, the reviews make a big difference to people finding the programme, so it's very much appreciated. We post a lot of visual material on the Instagram at about_buildings.
That may help. I mean, we are doing a podcast about architecture theory is perverse.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Like, a little bit of radio vision really helps.
Yeah, and it's all on there. And yeah, I think that's about it. We've just had the first couple of sunny days of the year.
It was snowing not very long ago.
Yeah. It's wonderful to be alive.
This house is very cold.
Yeah. Yeah. Enjoy spring.
Bye-bye.
Bye.